Mother's Day is almost here. Have you found that truly special sentimental gift for your mom yet? Don't worry, I got you. MyLifeInABook.com is a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges that she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and your children can treasure forever. Your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. I loved this idea so much that I've started my own My Life in a Book for my children to have. The thought of my son and daughter being able to learn about my life story as they grow into their own adulthood is truly special. It's been an enjoyable journey of self-reflection for me too, with questions like, which one event made the greatest impact on your life? It's brought back memories I didn't even know I had. I love it, and I know your mother will too. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code SERIALNAPPER at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code SERIALNAPPER for 10% off today. Stop. This message could save you from investing your precious time into a true crime story that goes nowhere. Avoid that disappointment. You need True Crime Feed Podcast. Unlimited, premium, true crime curated for you. Find out about a female serial dater turned serial killer. The truth about the DARE program, bizarre black markets, political murder plots, and a school for troubled teens so horrific it could be a Stephen King novel. You know those feels you get when you're turning into a primo true crime podcast? The thrill chills. You can't get enough. But not every podcast hits the same. You can spend hours sifting through mediocre shows that don't deliver the goods. Well, not anymore. True Crime Feed Podcast has your back. True Crime Feed sifts through the archives from the past decade to select the best cases and gives you a quick overview sprinkled with a teensy bit of humor, plus a weekly top three power ranking for shows currently trending, and lets you know what shows to send down your podcast queue trapdoor. You know you want those thrill chills, so come and get them. Subscribe to True Crime Feed. That's True Crime, F-E-E-D, wherever you get your podcasts. Hey everyone, my name is Nikki Young, and this is Serial Napper, the number one true crime podcast for naps. I'm back with another true crime story to lull you to sleep, or perhaps to give you nightmares. In 1950, Timothy Evans was accused of murdering his wife, Beryl, and their little baby girl, Geraldine. Timothy, a simple man who couldn't read or write, had lived with his little family in London's Notting Hill district on a top-floor flat. He refuted the accusations, instead claiming that it was actually his downstairs neighbor, John Christie, who had killed his wife and daughter during a botched home abortion. John Christie was a World War I and II veteran who lived in the ground-floor flat with his wife, Ethel. He would also serve as the chief prosecutor's witness during Timothy's murder trial, where Timothy was ultimately convicted and sentenced to hang. But just 3 years after Timothy's execution, a shocking discovery would be made. Bodies would be discovered in the walls and under the floorboards of John's ground floor flat. Had Timothy been telling the truth about his neighbor being the real killer of his wife and his baby? was this respected war veteran, John Christie, actually a serial killer who framed Timothy for murder? And what impact would all of this have on England's justice system? Let's jump right in. Timothy Evans was born in South Wales on November 20, 1924. Shortly before his birth, his father had abandoned their family, leaving his mother to raise him and his sisters all by herself. When Timothy was 8 years old, he was involved in an accident that caused him to develop a condition known as tubercular verruca, which is this kind of purple, rashy mass on the skin with warts. It's incredibly painful, and unfortunately for Timothy, it never really healed, causing him to miss a ton of school because he was getting treatment or he was just in too much pain. Because of this, Timothy struggled with his education, and he never really learned to read or write at the proper level. He was what you would consider illiterate. In 1935, his family moved to London, and in order to help keep food on the table, he picked up a job as a painter while he continued to struggle through school. He had tried working in the coal mines because it did pay more, but he had to quit because of all the pain his foot caused him. Eventually, he found himself working as a driver, though at times he had difficulties reading the map in order to get his customers to their destination. It wasn't an ideal career for him. In 1947, Timothy went on a blind date with a young girl named Beryl Thorley, which I've got to say has got to be one of the cutest names I've ever heard. She was 5 years younger than he was, just 18 years old, but they quickly fell in love and they decided to get married just 9 months later. After the wedding, the couple didn't have a whole lot of money, so they lived with Timothy's family. However, Beryl became pregnant shortly after that, and the home now was just too crowded to bring in a baby. The couple decided to move into their own place, a top-floor flat located at 10 Rillington Place in Notting Hill. Notting Hill today, the version that you see in the movie, is absolutely lovely, but that's not at all how it was in the 50s. It was an area that had been brutalized by bomb raids during the war, and it was home to many low-income families stacked one on top of the other. But it was home for Timothy and Beryl, and soon for their new baby girl, Geraldine. The building was divided into three living units: the top floor, where the Evans family lived, the middle unit, where an elderly man resided, however he spent most of his time in the hospital, and then there was the ground unit, where a middle-aged couple named John and Ethel Christie resided. The building didn't have electricity or indoor plumbing. Instead, there was a wash house located in the backyard that had a toilet and a sink. They used coal for heating and for lighting. Of course, this was the 50s, so it wasn't all that uncommon to live like this, especially if you were lower class. Times were tough, especially with a new baby to feed. Timothy was illiterate, he had health issues, and he walked with a limp. So any employment where he would be required to read or write or any hard physical labor was pretty much out of the question. He was able to get a job delivering produce around the city, but it didn't bring in much money, so Timothy and Beryl argued constantly about their finances. It was a real point of contention, and allegedly the whole neighborhood would hear their bickering. They were behind on paying their rent, and all of the furniture in their unit was purchased on credit. It was basically a rent-to-own type situation. They were struggling to figure out how they were going to stay afloat when in October of 1949, Beryl discovered that she was pregnant again. Timothy wanted to keep the baby. It was a surprise, it was kind of an accident, but a blessing nonetheless, despite the fact that he had no idea how he was going to support his growing family. Beryl, on the other hand, she felt that it would be best if she terminated her pregnancy. This caused even more conflict within the family, especially because abortion was illegal at the time. That doesn't mean that they weren't happening, because they obviously were. Oftentimes, different medications were recommended for women to take, which would cause a miscarriage or, you know, induce kind of an abortion. Other times, there were backstreet abortionists who would discreetly perform surgery to terminate pregnancies. all of which was very dangerous to both mom and baby, causing many to suffer from irreversible health issues or to die. During one of these arguments between Timothy and his wife Beryl over what to do about this pregnancy, John Christie, the ground floor neighbor, overheard all of the yelling. Allegedly, he approached the couple with a solution. John claimed that while he was serving in the Second World War, he was trained as a doctor. He had a medical textbook to prove it, which he pulled out and showed Timothy and Beryl. Of course, Timothy couldn't read any of what was written in the book, but it was certainly impressive to him. John was a middle-aged man who lived with his wife Ethel in the ground floor flat below the Evans family. He was a World War I veteran who had been seriously injured during a gas attack, leaving his eyesight and vocal cords permanently damaged. He had also served in World War II as a reserve policeman. He and his wife Ethel had separated for a time, during which John had been arrested for theft and assault, but they had reconciled in 1938, moving into the ground floor unit of Rillington Place together, where they had now lived for over a decade. John offered to secretly perform an abortion on Beryl. Timothy turned down the offer, worried about the health of his wife and his unborn baby, but Beryl was fully on board with the plan. She was going to terminate her pregnancy with or without her husband's support. A plan was hatched between John and Beryl to go through with the termination the following day. So the next day, Timothy went to work while his wife Beryl waited for John to come upstairs and perform the pregnancy termination. Later that day, when Timothy returned home from work, he found John Christie waiting at the bottom of the stairs for him. It wasn't good news. John told him that, unfortunately, there were complications, and his wife had died from septic poisoning during the operation. When Timothy went upstairs to his flat, he found his wife Beryl dead in their bed. Baby Geraldine was lying in her cot beside her, sleeping peacefully. Thankfully, she was unharmed. A plan had to be made, quickly. Abortions were illegal, so they couldn't exactly call the police or the hospital. According to Timothy, John told him that he would get rid of Beryl's body, and he knew of a family who lived in East Acton that could take baby Geraldine. He instructed Timothy to sell off everything that they owned for money and then to leave town, which Timothy did. He quit his jobs, he sold his belongings, and he left for Wales to stay with his aunt and uncle. But he couldn't stop thinking about what had happened to his wife and wondering if baby Geraldine was okay. It was driving him mad. To make matters worse, his aunt received a letter written by his mother, which was read to him over breakfast. Timothy's mother hadn't heard from her daughter-in-law, Beryl, in quite some time, and Beryl was known to keep in constant communication with her in-laws. Timothy's mother wanted to know what was going on, why her son had sold all of his belongings and up and left, and most importantly, she wanted to know where her daughter-in-law and her granddaughter was. It was only a matter of time until the truth was revealed, so Timothy decided it would be best to go to the police station and turn himself in. Now, here is where it gets really strange. For whatever reason, when Timothy arrives at the station, he tells the officer on duty that he has disposed of his wife, claiming, "I have put her down the drain." They quickly bring him into a room to question him further, and Timothy has a story to tell, but it's not the one that you think. I've found that the best way for me to be loving and accepting of myself is to be body neutral, meaning I'm at peace with the way that I look, and my only goal is to respect my body by making sure I take care of it. It's not about looking like an influencer. It's about feeling good in the body that I've been given. One of the ways I'm accomplishing this is by adding more foods to my routine that support my overall well-being. 310 Nutrition has been helping me with that goal with an amazing lineup of protein and superfood-rich products. One of my favorite products is the all-in-one shake. Sometimes I'm too busy or just straight up forgetful about eating breakfast, so I love that I can grab an all-in-one shake on the go to fuel me throughout the day. With flavors like chocolate bliss, vanilla cream, caramel sundae, and tropical coconut, you'll never get bored of the taste because they are insanely delicious. My favorite is chocolate, but if you're indecisive, 310 Nutrition offers a 4-shake flavor starter kit for just $9, so you can try them first. These plant-based protein shakes are packed with vitamins, and they keep me full with more than 25 organic fibers and superfoods blended in, so I can look and feel my best. Right now, 310 is celebrating a new year of goals with Serial Napper and giving you, my listeners, 50% off up to $100 off your first order. They offer a range of sample packs and seasonal flavors, so I know that you're going to be able to find something that you love, but absolutely you must try the chocolate. Just go to 310nutrition.com and use the code NAPPER, N-A-P-P-E-R, right now for 50% up to $100 off your first order. That's 310nutrition.com and use code NAPPER. I'll also have the details in my show notes. He tells the police about all of his financial troubles and how his wife discovered that she was pregnant but didn't want to keep the baby. He said that he met a man, a stranger, at a cafe who gave him pills that would induce a miscarriage. Timothy said that his wife took them, and when he came home from work the next day, he found her dead from these mysterious pills. So he got rid of her body. He dropped it down a sewage drain, which was located just in front of his apartment building. Then he left baby Geraldine with some kind strangers. He sold all of his belongings, and he left for Wales. He used this story in order to protect John Christie, his ground floor neighbor who had performed that illegal abortion on his wife. Now, with this information, the police go to the sewage drain to recover Beryl's body. They find the drain located just out front of 10 Rillington Place apartment building, where Timothy had lived. When they attempted to move the manhole cover, they noticed something immediately. It was far too heavy for just one man to move. It took them the power of 3 men to be able to move this cover, so Timothy couldn't have moved it alone. When they searched the drain, they found it empty. No body, no Beryl. The police returned to the station to question Timothy about his story. They couldn't find a shred of evidence to back up his statement. So what was the truth? This time, Timothy broke down and he opened up about his neighbor, John Christie, the war veteran. He told them about the illegal abortion, how his wife had died, and how John had somehow disposed of the body, but he wasn't sure exactly how. The police revisit 10 Rillington Place, and this time they search the inside of the building, looking for any clues as to what had happened to Timothy's wife, Beryl. Now, the first time that they searched, they didn't find anything at all, despite the fact that there were skeletal remains within just a few feet of where they were looking. During a more extensive search that was conducted about a week later, in the wash house, which was located in the overgrown backyard, the police make a shocking discovery. Near the wash house, just behind a stack of wood boards, the police find the bodies of both Beryl Evans and baby Geraldine wrapped up in a green tablecloth. The baby had not been given to a family to take care of. Furthermore, when a medical examiner looked at the bodies, it was revealed that there was never an abortion performed on Beryl. Instead, she had actually been strangled to death, and so had baby Geraldine. London police now believed that Timothy had made this whole abortion story up. They believed that the couple had probably been arguing about finances, and he just didn't want a family anymore, so he killed them both and then dumped their bodies in the backyard before fleeing. When they returned to further question Timothy, they presented him with his wife and his child's clothing, along with a piece of rope that they believed had been used to strangle them. Timothy genuinely looked shocked to learn that his daughter was dead, almost like he was hearing this information for the very first time. He was completely distraught. Now, we don't know all of the circumstances behind how this was done because this was the late 40s, 50s, so nothing was recorded. But Timothy confessed, stating that during one of their arguments, he had strangled his wife to death with a piece of rope. The next night, he strangled baby Geraldine. Then he disposed of both of their bodies in the overgrown backyard in the washhouse, hoping that no one would notice. He signed the confessions. There was nothing more to do. Timothy Evans was charged with murder. Now, almost immediately, Timothy recanted his statement. Now he was saying that his confession about John Christie was the real truth. When the police asked him why he had said he had killed his wife if he hadn't, Timothy claimed he was afraid of them beating him up if he didn't go along with it. He was also in shock over learning of the truth of what had happened to his wife and especially to his baby. And you have to remember, this was an illiterate man who would have needed extensive help in even forming his confession. The written confession itself is alleged to include police jargon that Timothy almost certainly wasn't capable of writing. So it's now believed that this was all likely coerced. But at that point, they fully believed he was guilty. Timothy's trial began on January 11th, 1950. He was only charged with baby Geraldine's murder, not with his wife's, because of the law at the time. And I couldn't find any further information other than that as to why he wouldn't have been charged with his wife's murder. Shockingly, Timothy's ground floor neighbor and the man that he accused of actually killing his wife was the star witness for the prosecution. Of course, he denied any of the allegations, including the idea that he offered to perform an abortion on Beryl. Both John and his wife Ethel would take the stand to talk about how often they heard Timothy and Beryl fighting upstairs about their finances. Additionally, they claimed that on the evening Beryl was allegedly killed, they heard a loud thud coming from the upstairs flat. They reported never seeing Beryl or baby Geraldine again after that. It was pretty damning testimony, especially considering that John Christie was a former military police officer and a war veteran, and Timothy, well, he was a layman who had changed his story now several times. It was basically Timothy's word against John's word. Still, when Timothy took the stand in defense of himself, he stuck to his guns. He claimed that his second confession involving John Christie was the truth. He refuted any claims that he had killed his wife or his daughter, but he wasn't as believable as John Christie, and after less than an hour of deliberation, the jury would find Timothy Evans guilty of murder. He was sentenced to death, which was mandatory at the time for a murder charge. Still proclaiming his innocence, Timothy would be hanged on March 9, 1950, a really speedy process compared to what we have today with death row. Life went back to normal for John Christie and his wife Ethel, at least for a while. They returned to their ground floor apartment at 10 Rillington Place for a few years before vacating. The landlord of the building allowed a new upstairs tenant to use the kitchen in the ground floor apartment where John and Ethel had lived. This tenant found the bodies of three women hidden in the pantry. When they called the police, there was a thorough search of the building and three more bodies would be found, including that of Ethel Christie, John's wife. None of Ethel's family had seen or heard from her in some time, but they had been told by John that she was sick and she needed to go away on some vacations to feel better. So he basically explained away her absence. Kathleen Maloney, Rita Nelson, Hectorina McLennan, they had all been found in the kitchen pantry. Ethel Christie was found under the floorboards in the front room. Ruth Forrest and Muriel Eady were both buried in a small garden which was located in the backyard next to the wash house. Shockingly, this was an area that had been previously searched by the police when they were looking for Beryl, but they completely missed it, not even noticing that a thigh bone had been used to prop up a trellis. The victims had all been strangled to death after he had used carbon monoxide on them to put them to sleep. And three of the women in the kitchen, they had all been sexually assaulted. John Christie, Timothy's downstairs neighbor, was a serial killer. The police arrested John and he confessed to everything. He admitted that he had killed his wife and the other women found at his home. He also admitted to killing Beryl Evans. He confessed that she had been seriously depressed over her new pregnancy, suicidal even. So he stepped in and he put her out of her misery. First, he gassed her using carbon monoxide, and once she had passed out, he strangled her to death. Though he denied killing baby Geraldine, and he would never admit to that. John would be found guilty of murder and was hanged in 1953 by the very same hangman who had executed Timothy Evans just 3 years prior. Now, many wondered if they had indeed hanged an innocent man who had tragically lost his wife and baby to a deranged serial killer who pretended to be a friendly neighbor. Opinions surrounding capital punishment in Britain began to change, with many pointing to the Timothy Evans case as an example of why it should be abolished. In 1965, the Murder Act was introduced, which abolished the death penalty in instances of murder. It was enacted and it was to remain in effect for 5 years as a sort of trial. This law was made permanent in 1969, and the death penalty in Britain was abolished for all crimes in 1998. In 2003, there would be an independent review of the Timothy Evans case, which concluded that, quote, "The conviction and execution of Timothy Evans for the murder of his child was wrongful and a miscarriage of justice." It was also noted that it was likely John Christie who had committed the murders. The Evans family was granted compensation to right the wrongs of the past, if you could call it that, meaning money was paid out by the government to two of his surviving sisters. Still, the family's efforts to have his murder conviction quashed have all failed because the cost and resources of quashing the conviction couldn't be justified since the innocent person and the person who probably actually did it are both dead. So technically, Timothy Evans' name has not been fully cleared. But it is most commonly accepted that Timothy Evans was an innocent man whose wife and daughter were actually murdered by a serial killer. He was a victim who was coerced into a false confession by police, probably because he was illiterate. He couldn't read, he couldn't write, he didn't understand everything that was happening, thus making the Timothy Evans case one of the most notable British examples of a great miscarriage of justice. But we are not ending here with Timothy Evans. Tune in next time to hear all about John Christie, serial killer and alleged necrophiliac. There is so much more to this story. That's it for me tonight. If you want to reach out, you can find me on Facebook at Serial Napper. I also have a Serial Napper true crime discussion group. It's called Serial Society, and I'll have the link in my show notes. I'd love to talk to you about this case and all of the other cases that I cover, plus everything else going on with true crime. You can find my audio on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. I post all of my episodes in video format over on YouTube, so go check it out. And if you are watching YouTube, I'd love if you can give me a thumbs up and subscribe. I'm over on X, formerly known as Twitter, at @Serial_Napper, and I post things on TikTok at @SerialNapperNick. Until next time, sweet dreams, stay kind, especially in the comments. Bye.